Hello everyone and welcome back to another day here at the Damage Report. It being a Wednesday though, it's a special day, as every Wednesday is. It's the day where we get to chat a bit with JR Jackson. JR, how's it going?
What's up? It's Wednesday or is it Tuesday?
No, don't even try to play that game. Oh my god. Oh god. I thought we had another day before the weekend. You really sold that.
I didn't think it was going to work that well. Honestly, it was like usually I push these things and try and act like and change people's minds and act like I'm missing something. But man, I didn't know it was going to work.
Oh my god. Okay. Well, now I guess I'm happy again. It's like going to a horror movie. You get that shot of endorphins afterward. But anyway,
I do have updates, John.
Updates on what? What's going on?
In case you haven't noticed, first of all, I'm hurt that you haven't noticed.
I just noticed when you said updates. What this happened?
It's painful. You know, it's more painful that you didn't notice.
But I did. But you didn't say it, and I already know what you're going to say. So technically, I get credit.
The quarantine beard has been eliminated. I'm back to seeing my normal shape of my chin rather than looking like my chin goes to my chest.
How come?
I made the store run and, mm-hmm. Spent tons of money. So I spent a good hour at the store. And you have a mask on for that long. I have the big mask that's very sealed and it's advanced and all that stuff. And as you're breathing, especially the little hairs above my lip, inside of a mask, they blow and they move.
Yep.
And they itch your nose. Then they itch your cheeks. Then the ones down here start itching the top of your chin. And then they start itching the jaws. And you're like, and the whole time walking through the store, I can't touch it and I can't move it and I can't scratch it. And I lost my mind. And I grabbed the clippers as soon as possible.
Look, for me, it was the first hot day. And I was like, oh, no, I guess I'm not doing this. This thing I'd mentally signed on to do for 3 months. No, I guess I'm not. This is the struggle of the pandemic that doesn't get enough press.
Yeah.
Trying to grow a beard in the struggle. And not just the beard, also. The first time when I had to wear a mask into a supermarket, I got out of my car. I put on my mask. I took a breath. And it fogged up my glasses. And then I took another breath and it fogged up my glasses again. I realized, oh no, it just does that every time you breathe with glass on the mask. And there's solutions, obviously. But yeah, that's the struggle's real, okay? And it's really on your face. But anyway, it looks good. Looks good. I think most people will agree we both look better having done this.
I wonder.
My wife just went, so maybe not everyone agrees. Anyway, okay, well, thank you for being here, JR. It's great to have you here. I think that we've got a pretty awesome rundown. A lot of serious news, obviously, but a little bit of hope and a little bit of fun. Creepy fun to close out. My favorite kind. A bit of creepy fun to close out the hour. Yeah. For everybody who is in the chat already, and there is a bunch of you, please hit the like button. We would love to hit 1,000. Maybe Sprocket will make another appearance if we get to 1,000 likes. Maybe if he wanders next to JR. But anyway, you can, of course, chat to us, send in super chats and all of that. We're going to be reading those in just a little bit. But with that, JR, you ready to jump on into this?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's do it. So we've known that the Joe Biden presidential campaign is going to be putting together some task forces integrating both his type of people, the Democratic Party, but also some progressives to try to unify these different areas and to produce recommendations on a number of different issue areas to both Joe Biden, but also to the DNC for their platform committee. And we now have details on what the 6 different unity task forces will look like. Most importantly, and certainly what's making the headlines, is that the climate change focused unity task force is going to include a pretty heavy hitter, and that is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who greeted the news of this by saying, after conferring with grassroots activists and climate allies, I'm accepting Bernie Sanders' nomination to co-chair, and not just on it, but co-chair the Climate Change Unity Task Force with Secretary John Kerry. Our planet is dangerously imperiled, and wherever there are decisions made, the people must have a voice. So we're going to have more both from her and also more of who is on some of these task forces. But JR, what's your immediate reaction?
It's good. I mean, we've got to have some representation and an acceptance of certain elements of the party that obviously are necessary and obviously represent a big portion of it. So enough of the right because of what you know, where they stand in party lines or what supporters look like of theirs. And whatever kind of in-battling that's been going on, this is to get something progressed. And this is the kind of thing I like to see. And I also wonder, I didn't get a chance to look up how detailed maybe supporters of AOC or supporters of Bernie Sanders don't like if there's this unity thing happening and they're going to be working with establishment figures, you know, say like John Kerry and those guys. But that's one of those things that's going to have to be ironed out and accepted, because what's the bottom line of what we want? Some kind of progress, right? And mm-hmm. sometimes other guys in power and other guys in positions of doing things, if they start to see your way, as long as then once you're there, your ideas aren't suppressed and you're just used as a pawn to be seen as a point of legitimacy, as long as that doesn't happen, yeah. I'm looking for the, I can't find the negative here.
Yeah, and by the way, so you acknowledging the possibility that either by design or just in the end that some of these individuals will just be used by pawns, it's, you know, intended to placate us and that sort of thing. Yeah. I think everyone is going to have that same belief going into it. And you're not wrong to believe that. And probably in the end, that's what it will be. But it's what we've got right now. And look, then, yeah. No, go on.
So, but the thing is, you have to, the hope is that if that happens, or if it begins, if your maybe her ideas or people from her element, part of the party's ideas begin to get suppressed, that they voice that as, hey, listen, we're not being heard. Let's go ahead and reset this rather than just allowing it to happen. Because you still have a voice to point out what's really happening.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And look, if it happens, I have a feeling she's probably going to say that. She's probably going to be clear about it. Like she is. I understand there are some people whose hobby is trying to find reasons to cancel AOC or throw her in the wood chipper or whatever. I'm not there personally. That's not the sort of progressive I am, where I just spend all of my time trying to identify sources of hope and shred them. But anyway, but we should be critical. And look, if you want to understand her thinking about this, about being included in this when, you know, she was obviously very critical of Joe Biden, both before and after he presumably became the nominee or will become the nominee. She has laid out her thinking, and she'll probably talk about it quite a bit in interviews. We're gonna reach out to her. Good luck to us. But anyway, we're going to try to talk to her about it, and you can find out more of what she thinks. So I want to read you at least one more of the tweets that she sent out this morning. She says, I have always believed that real change happens not with a panel or task force, but in everyday people organizing mass movements to demand change. Yet we should also commit to showing up everywhere, every space where there are decisions and formative conversations with movement voices. And so I am going to say, if I can speak for her, that she didn't join this panel because we got it. We're good. Green New Deal all the way. All our troubles are gone. But this is going to make recommendations. There is at least some chance some of them might be followed. And so to the extent that she can influence that, she wants to. And she's not just entering the committee. She's going to be co-chairing it with John Kerry. Yeah. Why John Kerry? I'm not 100% sure. He was a senator, Secretary of State. I guess. I don't see what that has to do with the environment. He's been pretty pro-fracking in the past, so we're going to have to see what his stance is on this. I imagine consistent with his past. But you also have Varshini Prakash of the Sunrise Movement as well, who also has a long tweet thread explaining, you know, her mixed feelings about joining up with this individual that she and a lot of people like her aren't super supportive of. You know, she mentions the allegations from Tara Reid as well. So all of this is out there. What they're trying to do is what they always do, which is, against seemingly impossible odds, nudge the country in the direction it needs to go.
Well, this is okay. And I guess this is where maybe many members of the audience or just progressives in general in the party may differ from me. We have to, and I said this from the beginning when Joe Biden jumped in the race. First of all, I haven't had a chance to gloat yet since Biden got the nomination, which I wasn't. I didn't vote for Joe Biden, and I didn't want him to get the nomination. But seemingly he has it, first of all. But there was this thought that there's not enough support for Joe Biden or from the establishment wing of the party. Just because the establishment wing of the Democratic Party is establishment and they're Republican light in many ways doesn't mean there's not a lot of Democrats that support them. That don't think establishment way. You know, they're just Democrats. And there are many of them probably Democrats that go, I've been Democrat my whole life. My dad was Democrat. My grandfather was a Democrat. Those type of people, which are a little annoying, but they exist and there's a lot of them. And so Biden represents that arm of it. So does John Kerry. So does a lot of these establishment folks. We have to, if we want any progress, we can't assume they don't exist. Mm-hmm. Just because I think it's pretty obvious. This is my bias now. it's pretty obvious that the progressive wing of the party actually has answers to move us forward in the country to benefit everybody. Mm-hmm. I believe that. But you still have to acknowledge that there's people that aren't there. They don't think the same way as you. So we still got to work with them, even though many of their ideas are a bit disastrous. But they exist. There's still people there that support them.
Yeah. Look, we're going to see. I'm going to follow along as the task force meets. You know, we have now people on the inside in it. We're going to be giving us information. That is, in this area, what we can hope for. We have to do, like, and you've read it in the tweet threads from both AOC and Varshini Prakash, we have to keep applying pressure in every way possible. That's what we have to do. We can just surrender. We can just back off. We can just exist as spectators to politics, you know, watching it from afar, feeling like we're better because we're not in the muck. Okay, there's certainly going to be people like that. And I get it. If you've been so beaten down by the experience of being involved in American politics, then, you know, I understand the desire to do that or even the reality of doing that. But thankfully, we have people like this who are not doing that. And in addition, that's two individuals who are in the climate task force. You also have people like Abdul El Sayed. He's in the healthcare focused one. You've got Pramila Jayapal as well. Individuals like Stephanie Kelton and Sarah Nelson, a number of others. Now, I don't want to get your hopes up too much. I am mentioning most of the people who I would consider to be on our side on these panels. There are others as well. But the majority are going to be, you know, the sort of people that Joe Biden and John Kerry and the DNC are very comfortable with. So those who have been drafted or suggested by Bernie Sanders onto these task forces, they have their work ahead of them. But I did want to read one of the graphics. This is from Senator Bernie Sanders. It was his response to the announcement today. He said, "I commend Joe Biden for working together with my campaign to assemble a group of leading thinkers and activists who can and will unify our party in a transformational and progressive direction." And I have a feeling that wherever he is right now, Bernie Sanders probably feels pretty similar to how you might be feeling hearing this. I mean, this is the best that we've got right now. The struggle continues. It is not the solution to all of our problems. We will have more to face in the future. But right now, this is what we've got.
It's what we've got. And then it's better than nothing. You know, there's voices on the panel. Again, I get if there's any frustration over it not being a sweeping across the board, everyone listens to us change. But that's generally not how it works. When you're coming from a position of trying to force people that are in power and they're used to doing their thing to do it in a better way, they're not willing to just listen to you just because. So it's good to get to start to have some tentacles into this. I like it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've been concerned since the beginning of the pandemic that there is not enough concern to people held in prisons and jails where we know that the coronavirus is beginning to spread. I was a part wrong, though. Some prisoners are being released from custody over concerns of coronavirus. It turns out, though, it's a particular type, though. President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, has been released from prison to serve the remainder of his sentence in home confinement because of concerns over the novel coronavirus. He's in an area, Loretto, Now, while there have been no known cases of coronavirus in that area, sources have told ABC News that the prison was an old monastery, and due to the open configuration of the prison, it's like a loft, it would be devastated by the virus. And by the way, it's not just Paul Manafort. You also have, let's see, Manafort's former deputy and co-conspirator Rick Gates had also asked to serve the rest of his 45-day intermittent prison term in home confinement. A federal judge instead suspended his prison sentence in light of the pandemic. Wow. And you also have Michael Cohen will be released to home confinement at the end of this month. So, JR, progress. Some prisoners are being released over concerns of the coronavirus.
Well, you know, and released, charges dropped or not even dropped.
Sentences,
you know,
suspended.
Suspended, moving on. Let's make it happen. You know, I guess the pandemic helped some people in this situation. You know, there was concerns and questions about other prisons and prisons with high populations of people with high numbers of COVID happening. And they were hoping for some of these things to happen, which some of them have. Some folks have come under, I'm not sure which parameters or guidelines they went with excusing them. But it's obvious that sometimes the guidelines for excusing or allowing people for home confinement is just that you've heard about them enough on the news. No matter if you heard about them being treasonous, no matter if you heard about them working with the president to do nefarious things against our government and our election system, none of that matters. As long as you've heard about them, then it's okay to release them. R. Kelly was also looking to get released. I don't think his number has been called yet, and I hope it doesn't. People like that. I don't know if Bill Cosby's trying to get on the list either. But we've heard about them, too. What is it about the crimes? Is it because, you know, they were assaulting people? Because, you know, I'm not sure which levels we're going to allow people to stay in or not stay in. I don't know. But this just seems like a fame thing. And I don't want to get too wrapped up or crazed about it because it is also the least surprising thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Powerful, well-connected people, they don't suffer the consequences of their actions. So look, do I want these particular people, do I want people released if they're, like, the standards that are being used generally by the DOJ apparently is they're generally prioritizing people who served more than half their term and have done non-violent, non-sexual crimes, which seems reasonable. I would say that regardless of what you do in terms of releasing people, and more should be done, you should also give a damn about the people that are not going to be released, and that seems to be entirely lacking. So, yeah. Look, I'm obviously opposed to these individuals, but yeah, if they have underlying conditions and all that, they should be released too. Let's also just acknowledge, though, that Paul Manafort doing the remainder of his sentence, and I believe he was originally slated to be released from prison November 4th, 2024. So that's a lot of additional, like, he hadn't served that much of his total term. Him being on, like, effectively house arrest, think about the house. Like, think about the conditions he's going to spend the next 4 years in. And by the way, it's a pandemic. We're all kind of going to be on house arrest for the next 4 years. Most of us just won't be in mansions. So that's what I would say.
There's some people that are upset when celebrities who have been on TV or interviews or whatever, and you see the background of their house, or they just post something, or maybe they went to IG Live, and people go, oh my God, look at their house. Oh, it must be nice to be cooped up. I was like, dude, you didn't know that they had mansions? You didn't know they lived in nice surroundings? I mean, that's the least surprising thing in the world.
That's true.
So, I mean, it's one of those things. They'll be the next ones on it. But I guess the question I also had was, for maybe we're talking about non-violent offenses or offenses where you didn't assault anyone else, maybe people on simple drug charges, they were caught with a certain amount of drugs on them, not dealing, you know, not kingpins, any of that stuff. Why? I don't know if they're not going to be highest on the list, because that's definitely a lot of general population people, I'm assuming. And many with three strike rules. All these things happen when people that are in prison. There's so many different ways people are in prison and away from their families when they're probably not much of a threat to society. I haven't looked deep in those cases, but I feel like maybe some of those should be prioritized.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. They got underlying conditions. You're going to let them go. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this was not just because obviously it's a very high profile case and everything, but because I want to remind people that so far as we have had evidence of, and it is difficult because people aren't really paying attention and they haven't really done testing, it is running rampant in a number of different prisons. We did really early coverage about the warnings about what was going to happen in Rikers, and indeed New York City prisons have been hit very hard. I saw a message from Real Justice Pack, which you should definitely pay more attention to, follow on Twitter and all that. They've done some great work. They said over 14,000 incarcerated people infected with COVID-19, more than 200 dead. One pregnant woman was told she'd be safer in jail. We can't continue to use connections and wealth as the standard to decide who gets spared from COVID-19 and who doesn't. But as of right now, that is very much what we're doing. And I just want to remind you, like, one, because I remembered this headline from a day or two ago on The Intercept. Tiffany Mofield died of coronavirus complications in a New Jersey prison after officials moved her from an area of the prison where she was quarantined for COVID-19 symptoms into solitary confinement, even though her symptoms persisted. I believe that she was being held in a shower, basically. Oh. And so, like, if you are an incredibly wealthy person who committed crimes for years and knows the right people, you can spend the next 4 years in your mansion doing just fine. But if you don't have those sorts of connections, you're probably not going to be tested. If you are, you're not going to be treated effectively, and you're going to be left to die, as dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of prisoners already have. That's the system we have. Very different outcomes depending on who you are and who you know.
Yeah, because think about it. You don't want the pandemic, or you don't want the virus to spread at the levels that it could. So you want to limit it in many ways as possible. What is this move? Why is this move accomplishing that final agenda? I don't see it. So if you've got a prison that has a high number and you're looking to eliminate some people that maybe aren't threats to society, that mm-hmm. might be where to start. Paul Manafort, in an area where there's zero cases, I don't see how that's limiting the number of things that are happening where the outbreak is going on.
So disappointing. Jared Kushner, who is, as of right now, in charge of everything in America, he was asked recently by Time about the possibility that the pandemic could interfere with the November election, and here is what he had to say.
Is there any scenario, including a second outbreak in the fall, where the elections move past November 3rd?
That's too far in the future to tell. Nothing that I'm aware of now, but again, our focus right now is just on getting the country.
Will you commit that the elections will happen on November 3rd?
It's not my decision to make, so I'm not sure I can commit one way or the other. But right now, that's the plan. And again, hopefully, by the time we get to, you know, September, October, November, we've done enough work with testing and with all the different things we're trying to do to prevent a future outbreak of the magnitude that would make a shutdown again.
Okay, so that's Jared Kushner. Every time I see him, I wonder, how is he involved in anything having to do with the U.S. government? I wouldn't hire him to scoop ice cream. Like, he seems anyway, but that's what we've got. That's our system. Okay, so JR, he does acknowledge there that it is not up to him, but says, you know, we don't really know. The plan is to have it on time, but it's really going to be dependent on what's happening with the coronavirus and everything. But like, Trump is planning to have it on time. Okay, so I'm reassured. What about you?
I'm not. But this was a little bit out of left field for him. Of course, I don't think he was expecting to be asked about moving the election. So it's going to be an odd 25% defense of him. He tried to play it even and go, I don't know, one way or another. You know, I don't think it's scheduled as far as I know. And I don't think we're going to move it. Why would we move it? You know, so it seemed like he was trying to say, this is out of my hands. Mm-hmm. Is someone else talking about moving the election? You know, and it ended up sounding like he's...
You think?
At this point, we're thinking about moving it, but not right now. See it that way.
I hope that that's what it is, because although he does say, well, you know, it's not my decision, I want to stick a pin in that, emphasize it a little bit. The opinion of a White House staff member has no bearing whatsoever on when the election is held. Even the president himself does not have the authority to unilaterally postpone Election Day, which by law takes place the Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So it's nice of him to acknowledge that it's not up to him, but it's totally, totally, totally not up to him, and not up to Donald Trump, and not up to anyone in the White House. They don't have anything to do with it, and obviously they don't and shouldn't have anything to do with it, because you don't get to determine when your re-election is held. That is not how it works.
That's the only thing he did miss, in knowing that, you know, nugget of information, that The question could have easily been shut down by him going, that's not in our hands. It's not in anyone in the White House's hands. It's not in my hands. It's not in Trump's hands. It's not in anyone's hands, you know, and then get it out. But he didn't know that. So, yeah, it's I hear it. But this is the problem. And I've said this so many times with Trump. There's a problem with having a track record of being a liar, of being undercutting our political norms and undercutting the American people for your insatiable amount of power you're looking to gain. Is that when you actually do something normal or actually don't have an answer to something, or you think you're answering something very evenly and lightly, like he thought he was, no one trusts you anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, no matter what you say, even if it's a slip of the tongue or if it's a missing information, people go, oh, this guy again. Yeah. You know why? Because it's been countless other times when this guy really was being nefarious and looking to undercut our system of government. So just keep it real. This, you've gotten yourself in this position of no one trusting you because you're not to be trusted.
Yeah, there's every reason to believe that he has both by intent and also as a result of all the time he spent in the White House is just going around the world setting up deals for himself and his family and people he knows. That's what it appears to be. Like last night, really fast, because we got more on this, Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and all of them were like, Dr. Fauci, why has he become so powerful? He's not accountable. Who voted for Jared Kushner? Who would vote for what Republican, what red hat wearing MAGA head would, I want Jared Kushner in charge of everything. Who would say that? Nobody. They don't have a problem with that. They have a problem with Fauci. Anyway, yep. Who's like advising people and is an actual doctor. Jared Kushner is a, what, failed Boy Scout? Yep. I don't know. He should not be in charge of the coronavirus response and Mideast peace and gun violence and all this stuff. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, quite literally the epitome of nepotism. Just keep it real. Are you okay with that? That's all. He's the dictionary definition.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to give the response because there has been controversy over that Time interview, which we showed you a portion of. Hours after his remarks generated a strong reaction, of which this video is a part of, he issued a clarification saying he was unaware of and not involved in any discussions about changing the date of the 2020 election, which is good, and I hope that he hasn't, but that does mean it was a weird thing to say. If that wasn't being talked about, then why even imply like it's up for either debate or for the White House to choose? Now, also, Donald Trump a couple of times has been quite clear, not that it matters to him what he's said in the past, but he's been quite clear that he is not going to delay the election, saying, I never even thought of changing the date of the election. Why would I do that? November 3rd. It's a good number. No, I look forward to that election. So even when saying the right thing, it's like gazing into the abyss with his brain. But anyway, he did say it, and so that's good. The thing is, JR, I am still worried, and it's because we know that he is someone who has undercut democracy in as many ways as possible. He wants to stay in office no matter what happens, and if it looked like he was going to lose, I am concerned about him doing something. And even right now, he is perhaps not intending to push back the election, but he is doing what's necessary, or he's giving us every indication that he is going to undermine our ability to have an election with saying things constantly like, I think a lot of people cheat with mail-in voting. It should be you go to a booth and you proudly display yourself. Understand, of course, that Donald Trump last voted by mail. He did not display himself, which reassured every woman. And look, we have him just recently with the California 25th district election tweeting that the Democrats have opened a voting booth. That's rigging it by opening up a booth. These votes shouldn't count. Scam. Now, look, they won that election, so you'll never hear anything about the fact that it was a scam and that a bunch of the votes shouldn't count. But what if they had lost? What if it had been close?
Yep.
What if Donald Trump loses and it's close? You think we're just going to, like, he's just going to be like, man, you know, we gave it the old college try. Guess I'm going to go back to real estate. I hope.
Let's not forget, 2016, he did the same thing right before the election. In the month leading up to the election, he was lowering expectations, but all he was doing was undercutting the validity of the election system because he thought he was going to lose. Constantly said he was setting up the narrative of they've cheated me. Didn't happen, so then therefore he dropped that whole narrative. He's pushing and waiting for it again. That's going to be the playbook because there's no such thing as a direct loss for President Trump. He has to say it was someone else's fault. Nothing's ever been his fault. So let's set up the it's someone else's fault for me losing line. He's ready for that again.
Yeah. And look, I understand if you're a Trump fan, if you're conservative, you're going to be like, oh, look at these libs implying that Trump is going to cheat things. Okay, good. Look, I hope not. I hope that it's a totally fair, free, and accessible election, that people get to participate in the election without putting their health at risk, their lives at risk. But I know that, by the way, even if we do have expanded mail-in voting, and even if the coronavirus is mostly gone and people can go to the polls without worrying, it's not like they're going to be participating in a fully functioning, awesome A-plus democracy. There's going to be huge gerrymandering, and polling places are going to be stripped out of certain areas suspiciously where certain types of demographics of people live. Like, that was the norm already, was we had at best a significantly flawed democracy, and they're only trying to make it worse right now.
They're setting up an entire thing to dismantle the legitimacy of it all, just in case Americans have picked up on enough of their BS and they're tired of it. Yeah. It's all this. You got set up to undermine it. And then enough people, without them even having to do it, will take that narrative and hopefully not, but take to, like, you know, the streets with their anger. And you see every time people take the streets in support of them, what do? They support it. No matter if they have guns, no matter if they're in the Capitol, no matter if they're threatening people, they're looking to support it because that's what they need, their foot soldiers to do that stuff, so they can say, hey, we didn't call for that to happen. It wasn't our fault. There's good people on both of those sides. So it's subtle things to progress that energy and that feeling. Mm-hmm. And again, this will be the biggest thing that he would have to fight against without having to explicitly fight against it and say that he's doing it. But he's been doing it.
Yeah. We're going to keep watching. We're going to see. Again, I mean, that guy that got...
You said it, but, like, it's explicitly, he's spoken against mail-in voting, and he's spoken against in-person voting. What's left, bro?
Vote by TikTok. For a long time, Donald Trump has been concerned about the haters, as I think we all have. At various points, he's wished the haters and losers Happy New Year. He wished them... the haters and losers a happy September 11th once. But despite his many overtures to the haters, Donald Trump appears right now to have a problem with the haters. And that's the people who hate politicians generally. So let's contrast 2016 with 2020 and see what these people that hate politicians, what effect they might have on the election. So back in 2016, nearly 20% of voters disliked both Clinton and Trump, hated both of them. Amongst them, Trump outperformed Clinton by about 17 percentage points. So that is one-fifth of the electorate he had an overwhelming advantage with. The haters loved him. That might not be extending to today. As of right now, according to a Monmouth University poll that was conducted last week, former Vice President Joe Biden leads Trump by more than 40 percentage points among these haters, and they now account for nearly a quarter of registered voters. So slightly more hate both candidates, but they are fairly dominantly going towards Joe Biden for whatever reason, and we can speculate.
Yeah, I didn't finish my thought earlier, but this is, and I said it yesterday in our production meeting, and I think everyone's not scoffing at me, but they're like, oh, you know, please. I don't think there's, again, this is my early prediction, because then things like, you know, voting numbers could change this. As you mentioned, gerrymandering, all these things that they put together to try and limit voting. If it all works, this could all be null and void. But as a matter of people actually getting to vote in a normal enough amount of time and manner, I don't think there's any way Joe Biden can lose. Honestly, he can stumble and bumble, and he can lose debates, and he can forget what he was going to say. He can do all that stuff. I don't think there's much of a chance that he can lose. And it's not because of how great of a candidate he is. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think he can lose. I just don't think he can lose. There's enough Republicans that hate Trump, the never Trump Republicans, that won't say it so brazenly as the Lincoln Project does, but they like that narrative. None of them liked him before he won in 2016. We always point it out, but we forget it ourselves. None of them liked him. The establishment Republicans did not like him. Established Republicans use him to do what they want to do, but if they get someone like Joe Biden in office, they're like, okay, cool, yeah, yeah. And then this Democrat gets this guy out of office that we hate, who happens to say he's a Republican, and we get to continue to do many of our things because Joe Biden keeps telling us, I'm willing to work with Republicans. Yeah, great. And honestly, that's kind of a good ploy for Biden because he's picking up all of those Republicans that also hate Trump. So it's
I don't know, man.
He keeps using the hate towards Trump to his own advantage without even really trying very much, because Trump does that to himself.
I think that Trump has produced a situation that has made Joe Biden far more electable than, absent context, Joe Biden would be. And I think, look, Trump has done everything possible to make as many people across the country that aren't already devotees of his cult hate him. That mm-hmm. is true. And he has also apparently decided as a campaign tactic to run against Barack Obama in this election, when Barack Obama is one of the most popular people in the country. Like, whether we think he should be or not, he is. So that's mm-hmm. a weird choice. But I don't know. Trump's approval rating is still like 44%. Seemingly nothing he does can break through to that core. I don't know if the core is going to be enough. But I want to show you one more polling result that makes me nervous. Even though Biden does have the hater advantage, Trump is trailing Biden by about 5 percentage points nationally, according to the Real Clear Politics polling average. And he's lagging in swing states, including in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Florida. But at this point in 2016, Clinton's national lead was slightly larger. And we saw that especially in those swing states, she came up just a little bit short. So Biden being a little bit tighter in those states right now. Now, look, Biden is doing better than Clinton in some other states. Like, I think he was leading in Georgia in one poll or something like that. He's close in Texas. But I don't know. I expect that all the people who love Trump, they are not going to sit home on election day. I think that the enthusiasm thing is real, and it uh-huh. makes me really worried.
I hear you. And that's the thing. That's why I almost want people to be more subdued with saying things like what I said. I don't think there's a chance he can lose, because that excites people who have been told that their guy's going to lose. It's like with a sporting event. There's so many parallels with politics and sporting events. So then, you know, people for the underdog side, once analysts have determined they're the underdog, start going, no, we're going to buck the system. We're going to take over. We're going to win anyway. So that excites people that think that they're in the corner of a potential loser to make sure that they don't look like they've supported a loser. So I get that. So I think that could motivate them to a degree, but you have to make sure you look. Now, if you're having the beneficial side of this analysis, make sure that you continue to motivate your voters. And that's, I think, where Biden has to come in and play both sides of this to be like, okay, I'm getting these people who hate Trump no matter what. Now I got to make sure that I also work with the people who are in this wing of my party that don't like the approach mm-hmm. I've taken, and really build a bigger coalition. That might be impossible to do because the agenda and the issues that each of them care about just don't match up. So I get that. And it's hard. That's why I would never want to be a politician. This is annoying stuff to think about.
Yeah.
Catered.
100%. So this is Brian Kilmeade, and I think he's on with Stuart Varney. And Brian Kilmeade, acknowledges the truth. And they have a little back and forth that I actually think I mostly agree with. Let me see what you think after we watch this.
I do actually think that Joe Biden is winning in most battleground states and on the national poll. Everything you said today is correct, Stuart, but still, there's something out there that people are still pulling for Joe Biden. It's up to Trump to find out what that is.
I haven't seen any enthusiasm. Have you seen a single lawn sign? Have you seen a single bumper sticker anywhere? I haven't.
No. But you know what you could be? Anti-Trump is Joe Biden.
Okay, so look, we've acknowledged the enthusiasm thing. So wait, why are you laughing exactly?
Stuart Varney's one of the dumbest. people in political analysis. What mm-hmm. is he talking about? So your gauge is bumper stickers and lawn signs.
Yeah,
bumper stickers and lawn signs. I live in a building. I don't live in a standalone house. My kid plays for this little league in the area. And they all gave us lawn signs with metal things and say, stick it in your lawn and say, my child is a member of this little league, right? And he was so excited. He goes, well, we got to have one. I said, why? Where are we going to put it, bro? So lawn signs? Lawn signs. So people in this country who don't live in standalone houses, you got to look for lawn signs from them before you get a determination of whether or not they support whatever candidate or not. And bumper stickers? You know, I'm not putting on my leased car is a bumper sticker. I'm going to get charged for that. You know, when you see people with bumper stickers in their cars, you go, oh, why would he destroy his car with that? Nobody puts bumper stickers on their car. If they do, they do it as a joke, or they do it because they just want to have a weird-looking car with tons of bumper stickers on it. That's your gauge is bumper stickers and lawn signs. Bumper stickers and lawn signs. How about little buttons that say Trump Pence 2020? I don't see any buttons of people walking around with buttons. Well, this Trump and Pence must lose because they don't have any buttons anymore. That's from 1936, bro. This isn't a thing that happens anymore. Nobody gives a damn about lawn signs and bumper stickers. Oh my God!
What about Trump Pence tramp stamps? I don't see a lot of Trump Pence tramp stamps these days. Okay, look, I get what you're saying, but I think that over, like, if you're not like, yes, don't, the bumper stickers and stuff is stupid, but the enthusiasm thing, I mean, that shows up in all the polls, and we know how crazed enthusiasm. Trump fans saying, are.
The gauge, I was stuck on that one point. I get there's still enthusiasm for Trump and Pence.
I get it.
Still runs rampant here, but yes.
So the reason I wanted to play the video is Brian Kilmeade is acknowledging the polls right now. And look, it's 6 months out. Like, God only knows what's going to happen in a week, let alone in 6 months. But what you should have seen there is if Brian Kilmeade is like, look, the polls show that Biden is currently winning. And Stuart Varney says, but there doesn't seem to be any enthusiasm about him, which we make the argument. Okay, then the next step is, so then why is he winning? And Brian Kilmeade actually dips his toe in that pool and says, well, there's this hate Trump, anti-Trump thing. Okay, why? Why?
They've never asked that.
Well, I understand they won't have the conversation on air, okay, but maybe think about it for like a second. If he's so good and the economy's so great and freedoms and liberty and stuff, why do so many people not like him? Like, consider that. It ain't even difficult. We're in the middle of a pandemic. 85,000 people or so have died. That may contribute, like that may be part of it. Maybe he's not doing the bang up job that you think he is. Maybe he could change course. Maybe you, since you have a direct line into his brain, could suggest he do things differently. I have made the case very often, and I've given different examples of how, that it would be shockingly easy for Donald Trump to win if he just used government money, not his money, to do a couple of good things. Take out all the lead pipes in Flint or whatever. Do a few of these things to show that he cares. It would be stupidly childlike easy for him to win.
Yeah.
But he doesn't.
Yeah. Because it would anger him and the people that are like him. They'd be like, how dare you give a scrap to those people who don't deserve it? What are they, Americans or something? So it's that it would actually hurt him in those circles, but it would help him in normal general circles. Because as we've already seen, when Trump doesn't trip over himself and smash his face into his teleprompter, people give him props. They're like, the president was so presidential today. He pronounced the word government without messing it up.
Yeah. Like,
The smallest things they give him credit for. So imagine if he actually does something that's beneficial to people. They'll fall over themselves to make sure they give him credit, and it will benefit him greatly. If he does it once and then goes back to doing all the craziness, it'll stick.
Yeah.
I don't want to give him this advice, but that's the way it would work.
Yeah, I don't think he's listening. Anyway, I'm saying in the comments, don't give him any tips, John. He ain't listening to me. Neither's Biden either, by the way. I could give him advice too. That would be pretty good. It'd be shockingly easy, a little bit harder to sell it in a live video, but anyway.
I mean, if he does it, you know how many lawn signs and bumper stickers and buttons you'll see on people? It'll be outstanding. They'll be everywhere. You'll see lawn signs on top of people's buildings. You'll see them sticking out of windows. You'll see people putting on bumper stickers on their brand new cars.
If you watch the news, particularly Fox News, they will tell you that the American people are sick of these lockdowns. They want to go back. They'll also tell you along the way that the quarantine didn't help. It didn't have any effect. Social distancing isn't required and masks are unscientific. And this will give you the impression, especially combined with the footage of the anti-lockdown protesters, that like a lot of Americans are really against these basic safety precautions. And I view that as gaslighting, and I don't want you to feel insane, so I want to reassure you that the vast, vast majority of the American people do not agree with these things, and I've got polling data to back it up. You are not going to be able to read this necessarily, but it is available if you want to find. And you can see, though, when asked, who do you agree with more on the issue of stores requiring customers to wear masks? We've seen videos of people complaining about that. Well, 84% of the American public agree with the stores requiring people to do that. 16% say it's an imposition on their rights. And by the way, 78% of Republicans agree with the stores. Now, they are more likely to agree with the rights thing, 22%. But still, overwhelmingly, even Republicans, even Trump supporters believe that, yes, clearly we should do these minimal things to protect the people around us, especially frontline workers. And so I find that to be reassuring. No, you're not crazy.
Yeah, it's good to see a few that there's still a majority of Americans that have common sense when it comes to something like this. And if you think about it, before COVID-19, days before the pandemic hit, there's stores and businesses that would have regulations on what you can do. The oldest sign ever created, no shoes, no shirt, no service, right? Mm-hmm. So if you go into a restaurant, you can't go in with no shirt on. And then as they're serving food and moving around you, that your armpits are just wafting near. That's something maybe a business doesn't want. Maybe others are cool with that. If you have a patio beachside restaurant, maybe people are sitting on the patio with no shirt on because they just came from the beach, right? Things like that. Yeah. It's different for each business, right? So, and people respected that. It's the business's choice. So if you go to this restaurant and you don't like to wear a shirt, maybe you just won't go. So the businesses have a responsibility to themselves and their employees and their customers to do whatever the hell they want to protect people and allow them to stay open. So if you don't like it, it's cool. You don't have to like it. Leave, bro.
Exactly.
I don't see why this is infringing on your freedoms. Man, every business has been allowed to do stuff like this. And there's a reason behind it. And I'm glad the majority of Americans still realize that, yeah, a mask is annoying, as I mentioned earlier, with your hair on your face blowing all over the place. And that's annoying, it's frustrating, and it drives you crazy. You know what also is frustrating and annoying and drives you dead is having COVID-19.
Yeah, 100%. And by the way, however frustrating it is to put on a mask and wait in a line to get into Pavilion and shop, and it is annoying and it's hot and all of that, those workers are wearing them all day long. So maybe bear that in mind. They're doing it so that they can work and also protect your health. They're not doing it for 20 minutes.
By the way, I'm one of those people, not as far as the mask wearing, but I don't want to stand in line. I haven't been to Trader Joe's this entire time. You know why? Because Trader Joe's was claustrophobic before any of this happened.
True.
It's definitely a problem now because now the line will stretch down the whole block and around the corner. And when I drive by it, I'm like, nope.
I've driven by it, not even intending to go, but those lines are long. I've had a couple times the supermarket I go to, I've been able to just walk right into.
Yeah.
But Trader Joe's was popular before.
I choose time of day and certain days when I'll go when it's low number of people there. That's just how I operate. But I'm not going to go around and complain and go, my child hasn't had Trader Joe's mini ravioli yet. You need to allow me in. No,
exactly.
I've chosen for him not to have the mini ravioli because I've chosen not to go to Trader Joe's. That's my choice. Trader Joe's doesn't care. Yeah. You know, it's okay.
JR, I have a constitutional right to Trader Joe's frozen spanakopita. Damn it, I want it now.
It's crazy. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, so we've been talking mostly about from the point of view of the shoppers, what do they think about being required. But if you own a store, it's actually good for you. So the other thing on this poll, by the way, on the left-hand side is more than 50% are more likely to shop at a place that requires the employees and all customers to wear masks. 65% of Democrats, even 38% of Republicans, which, by the way, that's an embarrassing gap there that they're so much less likely. But overall, more likely to want to go to stores that require it. And so it's in your business interest to do that as well. Really fast, I want to show you just a couple of other poll results. Take a look at this. So what do you think in terms of Trump's preparedness and all of that, what words would you use to describe him when it comes to the coronavirus? And the percent saying that he was unprepared has been trending up. We're going to show you the consequence of that in a minute. I would just say, look, it is good that the American public is realizing that he wasn't taking this seriously. I don't think that unprepared is really the word for it, because that implies like that you were taken by surprise. Nothing about this was surprising. He had all of the advice. He'd been given plans years out for this sort of thing to happen. He wasted weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. That's not being unprepared. That's being unconcerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's willful ignorance, if it's ignorance.
Yeah, it's pushing things aside, and we continue to see it. That's why the playbook is being flipped. That's why Obama's in the news now from this administration, also from Mitch McConnell, to claim things that aren't true, that it's someone else's fault. Hey, you know what he didn't do for us? No, you had that stuff. And you shoved it aside. CDC regulations, the playbook that was left by the previous administration, all those things are there, but they have to push the opposite narrative because these facts are slowly coming out and they can't just be caught, honestly, with being exposed at the way they've done this, which is to do nothing. Yeah. So, you know, they have to get ahead of it, which is already too late because they're kind of behind it.
Yeah. By the way, to go back just briefly to when we were talking about Brian Kilmeade and Stuart Varney having an opportunity to really learn something and opting not to, as always. So we've been saying from the beginning that the coronavirus could go one of two ways when it goes to the election. It's a disaster, and so maybe like with a war, the American people rally behind the president, or it's a disaster partially because of Trump, so maybe they turn against him. So I want to show you one more poll. So this is approval of the coronavirus response broken down by different groups. And you can see, if you zoom in and are not on mobile, if you are, good luck. I hope you got an iPad Pro. over time, almost all of these groups have been trending against Donald Trump. So overall, the March 23rd, the last week of March, he had plus 4% approval on his coronavirus response. That has trended down to negative 9 now. That's overall. But when you break it down by different groups, it's worse. So take a look at 65 plus. Back in the last week of March, he was plus 17 in that group. Now he's negative 6. If you take a look at independents, he was plus 10. Now he's negative 20. If you take people of color, he was negative 22. Now he's negative 40.
Jesus.
These are all obviously big groups in America in an objective sense, also kind of important groups in an election. And if the issue they hate you on, that could be bad for you.
It's, you know what, as things go on, this is the reason why they know all this. There's no way that the people around them don't know this stuff. As things continue and it stays in this same cycle of the president putting his face in front of this and saying things that don't make any sense and people ridiculing him for it and getting angry with him over it and dying over it, reality continues to live in everyone's face. So no matter how much he gets in front of a podium and starts berating reporters and yelling at people and then going on Twitter and complaining more there, no matter how much that goes, people lose family members, they lose friends, it's one degree of separation between these things that are happening. And that's when you can't deny it anymore. There's no more, my mother died, so then therefore I support Donald Trump because apparently this thing is fake. No, there's a reality in my face that my mother just died, so maybe this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So you can only gaslight someone so long before the reality shows them the exact opposite, especially when the person is even in front of you. You can't even like confront him about it. You just go, forget this guy. My reality is this, and he's telling me that it's not. Mm-hmm. That's where these numbers are going from. They believed him at first because there's a level of loyalty to him for some reason. And as they see that the reality has actually hurt them personally, now they're out. Now they're done. And the longer this goes, the more people experience the reality of his BS.
Yeah, it's hard to deny sickness. It's hard to deny death. I want to focus just one second on the non-white voters number there, because a lot of people believe that one of the big reasons Hillary Clinton lost was because she didn't inspire non-white voters. The support for her in those communities was down from Obama's two elections. And so for Joe Biden to win, he needs to shore up those numbers, and then combined with everything else going on right now, he probably has an okay chance. And so coronavirus hits, this group hates him on that because he's not doing anything. And we know that it's affecting non-white Americans far more than white Americans. So that's already a strike against Donald Trump. But the other one is, in terms of how he's going to run his election, what is Donald Trump's going strategy right now? Just attack Obama as much as possible.
Yep.
Which is an interesting choice to make when you need these voters to at least turn out for you 15%, 17%. And what has been his argument? Like for the last 4 years, it's you bring up the concerns of anyone who's not pasty white, and he will say, look at the unemployment rate and how it's down. Now there's like 30 million new unemployed. So that's going to be an even weaker response going into the general election. It's just such a disastrous strategy.
And that's all they've got left. And you know what? He's playing that playbook because it worked for him in 2016. He launched his campaign on racism and hatred for a certain group of people. And he's like, well, I don't have the false security of the economy to fall back on anymore. Because again, I can't say it enough times, the economy was never good for the majority of American people. So having a job at McDonald's doesn't count as being this great boom to everyone's pocketbooks in the country. So anyway, so that's what he rested his candidacy on before. And now that that's not there, he goes back to the original one, hatred and racism. So he's like, man, who's the biggest named person of color that I can hate and push all of my racist people against? Oh, I know. That same guy who I started with back when I wasn't even running yet, with birther talk is President Obama. Why not? It worked before. He's a simple-minded person, and he goes to just – that's what, you know, racists are ignorant people who don't think very deeply into things. Mm-hmm. That's how he is, and it's on full display. All he's got left is racism and hatred, which he was pushing the whole time anyway. Let's keep it real. But now that's all that's left.
In some areas of the country, a lot of stores are starting to open up again. Restaurants are starting to open up. That will happen even more in additional areas over the next few weeks, regardless of what the doctors say. And we know that a lot of these restaurants are going to be grappling with the fact that they need to socially distance. And so they're going to limit how many people are in their dining rooms, which means that you'd expect that in a lot of these restaurants, it's going to be sort of weird eating there. The servers are going to be in their masks. There's not going to be a lot of people there. Or does it mean that? Because one restaurant, the Inn at Little Washington, has come up with an alternative, and that is putting fully dressed mannequins to fill in all of the seats that aren't being used. Yes, fully dressed mannequins. And apparently, the chef, who majored in drama in college, has been working with Shirlington Signature Theater to get the faux humans costumed in 1940s-era garb. Servers will be instructed to pour them wine and to ask them about their evening. So they will not just be sitting there as decorations. They will be part of the fun, part of the show. JR, thoughts?
Well, first of all, this is I saw some of the pictures before we did this, and this is thoroughly frightening. It's nightmare-inducing. So if you can have mannequins have never been a thing that's I don't know, appealing. The most appealing mannequins are ones who are faceless. You know, if you go to a Nike store, these are the coolest mannequins.
Like
the Nike stores, they're like, and also any other sports stores, a lot of times they don't have heads on these mannequins and they're not flesh colored. They're like silver or black or white or something like that, the actual color white. Mm-hmm. And then so it doesn't look like a real person and it's just showing the clothes. If you see heads on mannequins with weird wigs and clothes on and in positions of where human beings would normally be, it just looks like they're about to get up and move. It's a horror movie. And you've got a throwback ambiance, like those tassel lights,
yep,
and old school garb. No, this is straight out of a, hey, how about a challenge, you guys? This is a haunted hotel. Come in, sit in the middle of the night and see how long you can make it. This is a reality show. Like they put hidden cameras up and nightlight vision cameras so people can sit there and you can see how scared they get at about 2-3 a.m. That's all this is, and it's great.
I think a creepy room full of mannequins was always missing one thing, and that's knives being everywhere. And wine to dull the senses. So, I don't think it's naturally as scary if you wanted to put them there. It's, for me, it's the making the servers pour them wine and talk to them. Because, like, okay, you just say that as a sentence and then you move on. But really think about it. The server is going to pour wine and say, hey, sir, how was your day? And then he's going to stand there and he's going to realize that he's being forced to do. I was a server for years. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to ask actual humans those questions, let alone a mannequin.
Yeah, how long do you wait for the non-answer to come?
Hours, JR. Hours. No, but it's the problem. JR, the problem isn't when the mannequins don't respond. The problem is eventually when they seem to, when you finally lost it.
This is going to start a whole new problem with restaurants in their some restaurants and their lack of serving certain folks, you know, exclusionary, discriminatory practices. So when black folks roll up in there and they're like, hey, so the mannequin continues to get attention from my server, and I haven't even gotten my main dish yet. Mm-hmm. It's going to start happening. Yeah. So the mannequins are starting to get the serving attention, and we're sitting here just waiting for our next one to come out. The sizzling fajitas, once they don't come out for me, I'm going to be very upset. Once they go and sit at this guy's table, I'm pissed.
Exactly. If they're feeding them. Yeah, I'm going to take wine from that guy's glass, by the way.
Totally.
I want to read one more statement from the chef, Patrick O'Connell, said, I think it would do people a world of good to reduce their anxiety level when they come out to a place which is still unaffected. Because if you watch your television, you think that there isn't such a place under a bubble. And I think that's a great point. I mean, like, you want to find a place that's unaffected. And who wouldn't think that when surrounded by creepy mannequins that nothing has changed? Also, there's a message from Chuck E. Cheese saying, hey, that's our thing. We put creepy animatronics.
Oh my god, no, that's the next step. No, if it goes long enough, if they want to be nice and complete about this, you got to eventually make them move. Maybe they'll start talking. AI.
But, And by the way, the servers apparently will be wearing custom-made masks bearing Marilyn Monroe smiles and George Washington chins.
Okay, this other thing. There was, I think, a jeweler that opened and some other things in Kentucky or Texas, one of those states. I think it was Texas. Anyways, they said, yeah, we're reopened, but nobody's coming out. So there's still going to be the fear for many people to go out, even under normal circumstances, once things reopen. So that is... So if you start slapping mannequins in there, I think that's going to be an extra limitation on people wanting to go visit your establishment. Maybe. That's all.
I just saw a comment from Mark Jackson who says, room full of stiffs. Yeah, very good. Look, obviously it's funny. They're getting a little bit dragged online. People saying it's creepy, but it's been a very rough time for restaurants. You need to get people back in. As you say, just because you reopen doesn't mean people will come. I think people will come to see how creepy it is. It's like not necessarily a bad idea in terms of getting butts in the seats.
Well, they're getting media attention for it, I see, right?
That's true. How often do we do news on the Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia? So anyway, if you are involved in that restaurant, if you were the chef, I'd love to try it. Just fly me out. Let me eat it. Not soon, but at some point, I would like to try that out. I'm now excited to welcome back to the program someone we haven't spoken to since June of last year, and obviously a lot has happened. Congressional candidate running in the 16th District of New York, Jamal Bowman. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's really good to be back.
Very glad to have you here. The last time you were on, the show was being hosted by my fill-in at the time, Brooke, and Brett was there as well. And so this is my first crack at talking with you. And, you know, I've been following along with your campaign, as a lot of people across the country have been. But for people who might be new to it, can you introduce yourselves to the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jamal Bowman, running for Congress in New York 16th Congressional District, challenging Elliot Engel in the primary. The 16th District includes the North Bronx and Lower Westchester County, which also includes Yonkers, Mount Vernon, and New Rochelle. And it's a tale of two districts, just like America is a tale of two countries. In one part of the district, you have incredible wealth and affluence and resources and opportunity. And in another part of the district, you have neglect of resources and abject poverty. And it's where... is that part of the district where I served for 10 years as a middle school principal. My background is education. I've served in public schools for the last 20 years, started my career as an elementary school teacher in the South Bronx, then became a high school guidance counselor for 3 years. And over the last 10 years, I've served as a middle school principal in Northeast Bronx, which, as I said, resides in the district. And after serving in education for about 8 years and realizing the neglect and inequality and lack of funding and lack of resources that our kids had to deal with, not just in the school system, but outside the school system, I decided to do something about it. So I organized parents, teachers, and students to begin brainstorming ideas for a new revolutionary middle school that we would open in the Bronx. This was during a time when Mayor Mike Bloomberg was trying to open up charter schools and attack teachers' unions and end public education. But we found a loophole to open up a new public district middle school in the Northeast Bronx. Wrote the proposal in 2008. We opened in 2009. And we made history doing great work at school for 10 and a half years.
That's awesome. And I've read very good things about what you've been able to accomplish there. And I know that you're both principal and innovator in education. I know that you also do a lot of trying to educate people about the links between education and other issue areas. You know, everything from immigration, homelessness, criminal justice, and all of that. Would you consider that to be one of the centerpieces of the campaign?
Absolutely. One of the reasons why I got into this race is because, you know, when you work in education, public schools and certain communities for that long, you realize and you learn intimately the impact of poverty on the lives of your kids. So poverty is not something that happens by accident. It doesn't happen because people are lazy. Some of the poorest people in this country work incredibly hard and work multiple jobs. It happens by design. It happens because of bad policy. And it happens because we have the wrong Democrats in office, not fighting for those who have been historically disenfranchised. So when you have poverty, you have children, and you have people dealing with food insecurity, housing insecurity, lack of economic opportunity, unsafe neighborhoods, and children can't thrive in school when they're dealing with all of these things going on outside of the school. So when we, you know, first considered running for office in this district and looked at Ellie Engel's record and look at his lack of presence, his lack of engagements, the fact that he continued to support corporate PACs and big donors and support weapons manufacturers, big banks, big pharmaceutical companies, big real estate companies, and not fighting for the needs that we have right here at home. We need 70,000 affordable homes right now in our district. We have many in this district, tens of thousands in our district who are uninsured and underinsured. You are three times more likely to die of asthma than you are anywhere else in the country. Our schools are underfunded by billions of dollars every year. So there's a lot of work to do here. There's a lot to fight for. And Elliot Engel hasn't been present leading those fights throughout his entire career.
So, of course, as many people watching will know, you're one of the Justice Democrats candidates, and you know, you are right next door, basically, to one of perhaps the best-known Justice Democrat candidates and now representatives, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Over the past couple of cycles, and including very recently, we've seen some, you know, hard losses of JD's. You had Jessica Cisneros just a couple of points away in Texas not that long ago, as well as wins. I mean, we had Kara Eastman just last night winning. As you've been, you've been doing your work, you know, and all of that, and watching these different sorts of races being run, what are some of the lessons that you've learned about the ways that these sorts of candidates running bold progressive campaigns like yours, how they've won and come up against some big challenges as well?
Well, winning is hard, you know, and running for office is hard, and we need as much support as possible, not just we in this district, in this race, but throughout the country. When you look at the progressive movement overall, we need all hands on deck, and we need everyone engaged, not just contributing, you know, a couple of dollars here and there, but volunteering, phone banking, you know, postcard writing, connecting via social media. This has to be a movement that includes all of us, and unfortunately, you know, throughout the last few decades, you know, the machine has, you know, persuaded people to believe that their voices do not matter and that they're not a part of the democratic process. And it's our job to make sure we engage everyone in the democratic process. So running for, you know, running for office is hard. Winning is obviously hard. We've been running a very strong campaign. We're very excited about where we are, and we're very close to pulling us out in the next 41 days on June 23rd, when we hopefully win this election.
I also wanted to talk about, you're not just running for Congress, you're running for Congress in one of the areas that has been, at least in terms of recorded cases of coronavirus, the hardest hit in the world, basically, which is a huge policy issue that needs to be dealt with, but also clearly affects the way that you can run your campaign, what sorts of activities are able to be done and what aren't. So what do you think about the response so far as it's affected your area, both from the state, you know, Governor Cuomo, but also the federal government's response? How would you rate that?
Yeah, the federal government receives an F, unfortunately. From the very beginning, we never responded with the sense of urgency that was needed regarding this pandemic. We were aware that it may be hitting our shores very soon, and we didn't respond urgently at all. Even after it hit our shores, the president still hasn't enacted the Defense Production Act with any sense of urgency. And as a result, thousands of people have died because of this. And we're talking nurses going to work every day, caring for the sick without PPEs, without masks, without gloves. Right here in Yonkers, where I live, we have the highest number of cases in Westchester County, followed by Mount Vernon, followed by New Rochelle. All three cities are located within our district. And the North Bronx, which includes, you know, the largest naturally occurring retirement community in the country, Co-op City, many seniors are living there, and they didn't have a testing site at the very beginning. And many of our public housing, NYCHA developments, did not have testing sites as well. So the federal response receives an F. I like the governor's response here in New Rochelle. As soon as the virus broke out, we responded very assertively and aggressively. We, you know, we contained an area. We brought in the National Guard. We helped with food distribution. We brought in a testing site. I just wish that urgency would have been replicated in Yonkers, in Mount Vernon, and in the North Bronx as well. We've been slow to respond in communities of color here locally and nationally, quite frankly. And unfortunately, we continue to see the the data that shows communities of color are disproportionately impacted by this number of cases and number of deaths, which is unacceptable.
And, you know, I know that you've been fighting for a long time advocating for Democratic leadership to propose bigger stimulus packages, more aid to the people who've been hurt worse by this. I believe it was just yesterday we saw their new proposal, the $3 trillion plan. What do you think about that, both what's included and what's not?
If we're focusing on small businesses and we're focusing on the working class, then it's a good plan. But what I haven't seen is a cancellation of rent, a cancellation of mom and pop mortgages, a cancellation of utilities. And we're calling for over $2,000 per month to working families in our country. I haven't seen that. So we're still not hitting the bar in terms of where we need to go in terms of a stimulus package, particularly in communities and districts like this one. It's a majority minority district. Many are working class. We have the highest number of WIC recipients across the country. We need help and we need support and we need cash in hand. So we're calling for over $2,000 per month, cancellation of rent, mortgage, and utilities so that people here can survive, you know, as long as this pandemic persists.
You know, I've been trying to figure out since the beginning of this, we at TYT here on the Damage Report, we've been advocating for a much stronger stimulus. I mean, the fact that up until right now, the best you can have hoped for is $1,200, and a lot of people haven't even gotten that. It was insufficient when it was passed, and it's only become more of a joke since then. But even the bill that they've proposed, lacking all of the things that you acknowledge, Mitch McConnell says it's dead on arrival. So I've been trying to figure out how exactly we get both Democratic leadership, but also get it passed. And I know you're involved in a number of digital events trying to raise awareness about, for instance, what like a green stimulus could do. I know you have an event with the Justice Democrats tomorrow. Is that sort of online organizing? Is that one of the best ways available to us to put pressure on the people in power right now?
I believe it is. It's online organizing, it's Zoom calls, it's Google Hangouts, it's Facebook Lives. It's also calling your elected officials' office and pushing them to be more assertive and more aggressive and challenging the Senate and challenging the Republicans in Congress. But again, we need more voices and more hands on deck and more people at the table. Right now, the progressive movement is doing very well. We're very strong, but we need to grow by the millions in order to move this country in the direction where it needs to go. Obviously, this election cycle, we have to beat Trump, flip the Senate, and get the right Democrats in office. But going forward, we have to look to a future that we've never seen before. And we have to provide the vision, the creativity, and the imagination to build that future. And it's going to be progressives that build that future together. So my hope is, in addition to organizing the way we have been doing and connecting with the grassroots and growing the grassroots, we bring in people who have lost faith in our political system to lean in and have more hope and faith in what's possible. And that's what I, as a candidate, has been able to do. And that's what our campaign's been able to do as well.
If people want to find out more about that campaign, about your platform and your background, where can they do that?
BowmanForCongress.com. Please check us out. You can volunteer. You can make a contribution. You can help us out tremendously. So please go to BowmanForCongress.com and help us bring home this victory on June 23rd.
Jamal Bowman, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.